What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
And I asked one of the guys about his time on that submarine, and he told me that he had been to Murmansk with that submarine. So I'd never heard about that. So I asked him, is that something you're allowed to talk about? Well, I don't know. I just tell it everyone is visiting the submarine.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com.
During the Cold War, six Dutch submarines secretly gathered intelligence about the Soviet Navy. Only a handful of people outside the Royal Netherlands Navy were aware of these operations, and they were not part of NATO operations. Thanks to our latest supporters, Victor Osprey, Joe Collins, Eric Thielander, and Andrew Tyler, who are helping us financially for the price of a cup of coffee or two a month to cover our increasing costs and keep us on the air. They will shortly be the proud owners of a Cold War Conversations coaster. Don't you want one too? Just go to patreon.com/coldwarpod. That's patreon.com/coldwarpod. For the first time, In Deepest Secrecy describes these top secret deployments in detail. On the basis of interviews and archival research, Jamie Karaman reveals how Dutch submarines followed, photographed, and listened to Soviet ships unnoticed from the freezing Arctic Ocean to the shallow waters near Egypt. We welcome Jamie Karaman to Cold War Conversations.
Welcome to Cold War Conversations, Jamie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Jamie, you've served in the Navy. Is that where your sort of interest in this subject has come from?
Well, the interest in the subject came from a visit to the Navy days, the Dutch Navy days in 1987. And 10 years later, I joined the Royal Netherlands Navy. But the interest in the subject about submarines, that started when I was for a report in with a Dutch submarine during the Dutch submarine commanding officer qualifying course. And that was in Scotland on the Clyde. Really interesting. And when we flew back with the commanding officer of the submarine service, we had a technical failure with our airplane where we are still in Glasgow Airport, and we had a delay of 7 hours. So we could talk about a lot of different things, and also about his Cold War adventures a bit. And I asked him, is it possible to write already some books or articles about that time?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, sure, yeah, that's all, it's all in, declassified now. But that wasn't.
So it was somewhat of a challenge then.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll get onto that in a moment. Now, your book starts in 1968. What was the Royal Netherlands Navy submarine service up to in the early Cold War years and prior to that point?
Well, the submarine service suffered great loss, of course, during the Second World War. And there was the submarine service was on paper that survived, but there was almost nothing left. So they got some submarines from the UK and from the US and tried to recover from that time. And in the meantime, there were some a lot of difficulties with the Dutch colonies in the East, in the Dutch East Indies. And but the I think only in the late 50s or so Dutch submarines were involved in that for quite a short time. After that episode was closed, the Dutch Navy focused more and more on the on NATO and the North Atlantic. And in that time, in 1960, the new Dutch designed and Dutch built submarine class three cylinders joined service. So that was with a new submarine, with the new, well, it was more designed like the what the Dutch Navy wanted. They started a new period.
Right, and that's the submarine that the type that I went and saw yesterday, the Tonijn. Tonijn.
Yeah.
I knew I was going to get that wrong. The Tonijn that's at the Navy Museum at Den Helder, which was a fascinating visit, but we'll probably talk a little bit about that later as well. I think one of the things that interested me from your story being British was the close relationship with the British Royal Navy. How did that come about?
Well, it started in the Second World War, because before that, there was, especially on industry level, there was a close cooperation with German industry. But in the Second World War, obviously, the Dutch Navy, a part of it was based in the UK. Also, the submarines, the Dutch submarines were, they joined the Royal Navy.
Right. So when Holland was invaded, they came over to Britain
with their submarines. Some of the submarines were just taken from the shipyards. There were some of them. I think the O-24 didn't even have a sea trial. So that was the first time they had when they went to sea. There was the real thing immediately, and they had to go to the UK, and then they were. They became part of the submarine flotilla in most of them in Scotland. So that was where that began. And a lot of all the commanding officers, they did the qualifying course for the commanding officer qualifying course for the Royal Navy. So that's where that started.
Okay. And the qualifying course is sort of got a nickname to it, hasn't it? It's called the Perisher.
Perisher, yes.
Course. Can you just give a little bit more about that course?
Well, that started a bit earlier in the Royal Navy, because they wanted to have better qualified commanding officers, and the Dutch Navy didn't have that course. So when they came over to the UK, they got familiar with that course, and that is. When you're on the commanding officer of a diesel electric submarine, especially in that time, you're the only one who gets all the information. You have to handle all this information. You have to make the decision. You're the only one who's looking through the periscope. So you need someone who is trained really well. And not only to know how to fight with a submarine, but also how to handle the people in the control room and all the data getting in. So and that course is quite familiar, because it's really hard, especially the final phase of it, when if you make one mistake, you get
that's it, you're out.
You're out. Right. Yeah. And it's not that when you're out, it's when it's told to you, then you get a boat will be arranged and you get off the submarine.
Wow, it's
so
that
final. It's the end of the career, end of your submarine career, because
right.
You can't. If you failed that exam, you're not allowed anymore to be a commanding officer on a submarine. So that's really hard, because those guys have been in the submarine service for most of the time for around 10 years. And that is everything in that 10 years is leading up to that qualifying course, of course. Because that's what they want eventually.
So it's really high stakes
that
you come to that. Wow. And there's more detail in the book. We don't want to reveal everything, but Jamie does go into a little bit more detail as to what that course consists of.
Yeah. And that course is a part, of course, of this cooperation between the UK and the Netherlands. And I think from that time on until now, you see that also in the Dutch submarine service, there is a link between with the UK submarine service.
Yeah. So we've forgiven you over Chatham then. When was that? 16 something or other?
Yeah, 1665.
Or yeah, something. Famous Dutch victory over the Royal Navy, where they sailed up the River Medway and sank most of our fleet and took one boat back with them, I think, at Chatham. But anyway, we're here to talk about Cold War, not 1600s. I understand also that some of the Dutch submarines were deployed with British squadrons as well, like at bases like Faz Lane. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, there was in the 70s, there was a close cooperation with the Royal Navy, and that was because the Dutch submarine service is obviously based in Den Helder, but there the North Sea in that part is too shallow. So every time they had to go to their station, that was in the North Atlantic, they had to transit there for a day or two. And when you're based in Faz Lane, with a big submarine base with all those facilities, the idea was that was much closer, much better, because it's closer to your patrol area. But it's also good to get more familiar with the cooperation with other submarines. And it was, I think, maybe 10 years or so that the Dutch submarines were that closely cooperating with the Royal Navy submarines. And there was, for one submarine at the time, Dutch submarine at the time, that was the Faz Lane, was its home base.
Right, right. Okay. Okay, and because Faz Lane's famous for the nuclear submarines, but it's worth just noting here that the Dutch submarines we're talking about a diesel electric submarine, so do need snorkeling, I think, to keep going.
Yeah,
keep going. I mean, that's not a great term, but anyway, I think you know what I mean.
Yeah, that's true. Diesel electric submarines. The Dutch tried to obtain nuclear submarines as well in the 60s, in the 70s. First with the Americans, and after that failed with the French. But in the end, I think it's better for the Dutch Navy to have the diesel electric submarines, especially because Britain got rid of them in the 90s. After the Royal Navy turned to nuclear only submarines, the Dutch took over the Paris Accords that started in 1994. So the Dutch have now the commanding officer qualifying course. That's the submarine commanding officers, the submarine commanding course. That since 1994, so also Australian submariners and submariners from Singapore, Chile, or everywhere, they go to Den Helder for their commanding officer course.
Oh, okay. I hadn't realized that the Dutch had taken over the course, but obviously it makes sense as there's nobody else using. I mean, so the British and the Americans don't use diesel electric at all. They're all nuclear.
Yeah,
nuclear power.
And the French as well.
Right.
And there's also another very important part in my book in that time frame from 68 to the end of the Cold War, that a lot of information is needed from the Soviet fleet, and then a lot of people realize that that's only or maybe better to use diesel electric submarines. So, but maybe you wanted the question.
Yeah, no, not necessarily. I mean, I'm interested to know the advantages of diesel electric over nuclear, because I would have thought nuclear would be better because they'd be quieter, but that's me probably not understanding the technicalities.
Well, during the Cold War, the nuclear submarines were not quieter than these electric submarines. When you have a nuclear submarine, you have a lot of pumps and there's a lot of noise in the submarine. And when you have a diesel electric submarine that's running on batteries, not snorkeling, but when it's on batteries, then it's really quiet. In that time, after the Second World War, the Germans, they had obviously a really big submarine fleet, but then after that Second World War, they're not allowed to build larger submarines. So only very small submarines designed for the Baltic Sea. So that meant that the Germans, the Norwegians, and the Swedes have their own submarines for their coastal waters, the Baltic or the coastal waters in the North Atlantic. Well, the French were in that time frame a bit out of NATO. And so you have the UK, obviously, with their Oberon class submarines for a large part during the Cold War. And in the Mediterranean, there were a lot of other nations with their submarines. But most of them were for coastal operations. When it appeared that the Soviets had anchorages in the Mediterranean, for example, near Egypt and Libya and Tunisia, then it was very clear that you need submarines that can travel quite some distance, because there were no NATO ports next to them, of course, in the Mediterranean, but not in Egypt. So you need a submarine that can travel some distance, can stay there for a longer time, and also can visit the anchorage in a very shallow area.
Right.
And also you need a submarine that's big enough to accommodate people who can handle all the data that's coming in and analyze it.
Okay. Let's come to the missions then in more detail, because I think we're now getting into that area. So the Royal Netherlands Navy mission was to gather intelligence on the Soviets. What intelligence were they trying to get hold of?
A lot of intelligence, because a submarine can get a lot of information about the ships, and that is about the Soviet fleet. There are a lot of course, the submarines have a lot of sensors. They can detect or record acoustic signature, acoustic noise. They can also have a look through the periscope and record it with a videotape that was used. I think the first time I read about that was during a patrol in the early 70s. They can record the data that's emitted by the signals emitted by radar.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is that the submarine can do that for a long time and gather all this information simultaneously. So not only a bit acoustic signature, acoustic noise, but also the radar image and the image of the ships, and you can combine it, so you have a complete fingerprint of this ship, because every radar and every ship has its own signature, because you have a lot of pumps and generators, and they emit generally the same noise, but if you analyze that, then you see that you have a lot of different things in it.
So you could identify the type of submarine by...
Well, not only the type, that's the interesting thing. The type, but also if you're analyzing really well, you can even analyze the exact... What is you can differentiate the exact submarine or ship.
Because I mean, I've heard of stories where they can tell whether one of the cylinders is cracked or something, and it is that level of detail, is it?
Yeah.
So Jonesy on Hunt for Red October, that is quite well based on fact, then.
Yeah, but that's what they did was they used a special device as a frequency analyzing sonar. And so that was not on just by hearing it.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, I couldn't avoid Hunt for Red October, one of my favorite films. But okay, so so they're trying to take photographs of Soviet ships. They're listening to the sound and radio waves emitted from these ships. I think I read that the Russians were potentially quite clever. I guess this could have happened by accident, but they were using the same engines in their trawlers that they used in some of the submarines.
Yeah.
And so the acoustic signature could be quite similar there.
Yeah, that's true. But you have a different... the acoustic signature of that engine is the same. But then you have all the noise, emitted noise by the machinery that's not on the sound absorbing material. And... you have a different screw, so that's a different propeller.
Yeah. So is it possible to detect any submarine, or can a submarine actually go completely silent and not be heard at all?
You mean in that time frame?
In that time frame, yes.
Of course, when the submarine is... it depends, of course, on how your sonar or how good your sensors are.
Yeah.
What the how good your team is, your sonar operators are. And when a submarine is operated very well, and it's also when you're lucky and it's in an below a temperature layer, then it's really hard to detect the submarine.
Right.
Or maybe, for example, in the Baltic Sea, that it's quite common to bottom the submarine on the seabed.
Right.
Turn off all the machinery.
Yeah.
And then it's really quiet.
Okay. The reason I ask is I interviewed a Canadian anti-submarine warfare specialist who worked with the Royal Canadian Air Force. And he reckoned that the British Polaris and Trident submarines, they could detect them. They knew where they were. Despite the fact that the British government say they're completely invisible, and I'm just trying to work out.
I don't know about that. There were nuclear submarines, of course. And I can imagine that when you have a nuclear submarine and an MPA is dropping sonar buoys in that time frame, that maybe you can hear them. But it depends on... On, like I said, on all the
circumstances of the capability of the operator, the temperature of the seawater, loads of other variables by the sound of it.
Yeah.
Okay. Can we talk about just a few of the missions, just to give listeners a flavor of what you've got in your book? Because it is packed with many missions. But I think one of the ones that I quite like was the Russian trawler that was off Malin Head that was, I think it's called an AGI, which is Auxiliary General Intelligence.
Yeah.
Hey, you see, I've done notes as well here. Now, this one was really an amusing story because they were apparently monitoring this trawler and they detected that it was moving closer to the British coast every time there was a football match on so that they could watch it on TV.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the Dutch submarines was operating in that area in UK waters because it was based in the fast lane. And also, of course, the Royal Navy submarines were operating there. But whenever there was, they needed the Dutch submarine that was, then that was sent to that patrol area. And that's a very famous, the Malin Head AGI is very famous in that time. It was there to get intelligence about the Royal Navy SSBNs, the nuclear submarines with ballistic missiles, and also the American ones. But it was not only gathering intelligence, but it was also harassing them sometimes. But they liked football because I spoke to one of the commanding officers that actually saw them watching football matches.
What, through his periscope?
Through his periscope.
Brilliant.
Yeah. There was a green light lighting up in the crew area. And that's what you get when you're just there a few minutes or seconds or a few hours watching such a trawler with an airplane or with another ship. Then you have only a moment, a few snapshots of their behavior. But when you're there for days or some weeks, you know all the routines. And eventually he knew exactly what time they had they did the morning exercises and the all the routines. The same captain also told me that he did that the same in the Mediterranean, and he saw the crew, the Soviet crew, line up on that destroyer he was watching that was in the anchorage every hour at 8 o'clock, and they all watched. They looked at the same time, at the same direction, of course, and then he passed with his periscope the other side, and he could take pictures.
Brilliant. So he knew they were looking in the wrong direction. So
they were just lined up,
right?
And yeah, he knew that he was not
going to be detected. He was unlikely to be detected.
Yeah, and that is what you also want to know. You want to know what is the behavior of this possible opponent, because when you know that at 12 o'clock they have a new watch coming on. That's not what you're going to see, because they are inside and inside the control room or inside the ops room. But you can record that when you see the change of the radar.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
When it's emitting, there are some differences in the preferences or the frequencies or some other things. Because that's what they do when that's what every radar operator does when he's there in starting his watch. He's adjusting his seat, he's adjusting his earphones, and he's adjusting his radar.
Yeah.
And that's what you see. If you see that every day at 12 o'clock, then you know then, okay, that's the moment then you, that they're not really
ready for attack. Right. That is fascinating. Fascinating stuff. How secret were these operations?
They are still very secret.
So why are we talking about them now?
Yeah, why are we talking about it now, and why I wrote a book about it? That is because some parts of it, a lot of that's really history. Mm-hmm. We're talking about submarines that don't exist anymore or are part of a museum. Tactics that they're in the history books, and some other things that are very obvious, and we're talking about, and we can talk about it because in the Dutch National Archives there were the captain's logs of all the Dutch submarines, and that was obviously a mistake, but. Every submarine or every ship has a captain's log, ship's log, and every 6 hours, the crew or one of the officers wrote down all the things that happened with the submarine or in that watch in the past 6 hours. So, but it was known that it was open source. So they had when it was closed. 25 years later, it would be in the archives. So it was not allowed to write down sensitive information. But at that time, it is really hard to know exactly what is still secret in 25 years. And so they wrote down what they thought it was open. It was not that sensitive because the next to that ship's log, they had the patrol reports. And that was the really secret stuff. So all the results of the patrol, what they did,
the
what ships they encountered. And sometimes they had the ship's log for some special for a patrol. And then they used stamps and put on secret or NL eyes only. But when you do that on a document that is not secret, you can put on many stamps you want, but it is still not secret. So after 25 years, it went as well to the National Archives. And when I started, I visited my the book actually. The first thing I did was, of course, the talk with the commanding officer, submarine service in Glasgow at Glasgow Airport. But I think 1 year later, I went to the Tonijn, the Naval Museum, and with that information in my head. And I asked. It was exactly the same windy atmosphere, windy, rainy day like you had yesterday.
Yeah, the joyous Dutch weather I had yesterday. Yeah,
so there was no one at the museum. There was no one at the submarine except for the personnel working there. And I asked one of the guys about his time on that submarine, and he told me that he had been to Murmansk with that submarine. Okay. So I got really, I'd never heard about that. And so I asked him, is that something you're allowed to talk about? Well, I don't know. I just tell it everyone is visiting the submarine. Okay. Then.
So I'd call that open source then.
Yeah. At that time I thought, well, I have to write it down. I have to do something with it. So I started to interview with, one of the guys, one of the submarine veterans, and he told me about a lot of information about that time frame, but he couldn't remember a lot of details. So the next thing I did was I called to the history, the department of the armed forces in the Netherlands, and I asked them, where can I find those patrol reports? And then they laughed, of course. So, well, they're still very secret, and we don't know even where they are.
Even 30 years after they were, or more than 30 more. Years than that.
50
than,
years.
Yeah.
So, okay. And then the historians I spoke, they told me, go to the National Archives. There you'll find the ship's logs, but there's nothing in it. But every historian was repeating that. And if everyone is saying there's nothing interesting in those ship's logs, then no one is, of course, having a look in it. And I was there for another reason at the National Archives, and I asked one of those ship's logs, and it was just looking in them. And suddenly I saw some short information, sort of snippets of a patrol. So then I decided to digitize all the 150 ship's logs, 50,000 pages. It took me 1 year to do that.
Really, that quick?
Yeah, I could do. Yeah, I was really trained after to do that really fast. So, and it was also really strange because the part of the area when you can look in all those in the archives, that is for secret material, and there's also one guy of the National Archives next to that table is watching that you're not taking pictures and you're only allowed to write something down. So the first time I went there with the ship's logs, I went to that table. And he sent me away because he said, that's not a secret document. So you have to go to the public part. And he said, if you're having a camera, you can also take pictures of it. So I thought, well, if this is not secret, what is the information on that table?
Yeah, yeah.
But that was a mistake, because when I combined all this information with all the also crew lists in it, and some ships like were there already for 25 years, so I'm sure I was not the first one to see that. I'm for sure the Russian embassy had their trainees started for years. So that was okay. So I digitized that and I analyzed all the information and I found 60 patrols in that area.
Right.
But that is because it was open source. So that's one part. It was open source. And another thing is that the submariners, the Cold War submariners, are not seen as veterans. They're not in the Netherlands, they're not recognized as veterans because they were not on an official mission. It was just, the government says they were only on exercises. That is because these operations were so secret that they're not recognized. So, and that is, in the beginning, they accepted that. But now, after all those years, and their requests have been turned down many times, they're a little bit, and they're turning older, of course.
Yeah.
So a lot of guys said to me, okay, now I'm willing to talk about this because we have to talk. We have to tell people what we did and not only doing exercises or just waiting in port. But we did a lot of things that were really dangerous and really important. And if we don't get we're not getting a veteran status because they're not invited to the National Veteran Day.
That's just shocking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really sad.
That is sad. Yeah. I mean, when you read the book and you realize the dangers of what they were actually doing, I mean, they were almost in combat. You know, they were in danger of being sunk by Soviet ships if they got too close or got in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah. So that's why a lot of guys were really willing to tell more details about it. And they also said that this is the first time I'm telling this story to someone who's not in the submarine service. Even their wives and their kids, they didn't know about it. And so their family, the first time they heard about it, read about it, it was in my book. And sometimes 50 years after that mission. And like you said, there were some times that it was really dangerous.
Mm.
They did a lot of underwater looks.
Can you just define what an underwater look is?
Okay, that's if a submarine wants to know more about the ship, you can obviously gather the information from some distance. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you want to see the exact layout of the propeller and the bottom of the ship. So the only possible way to do that when the ship is at sea is with a submarine to go underneath the ship or underneath the submarine. It's even more dangerous, but this was also done. And take a picture or film to complete underside of that ship.
And was that film taken through the periscope?
Yeah.
Or you can't really see where you're going in a submarine easily. Or is that because I mean, this must be really precision work to try and not hit the target that you're trying to examine.
Yeah. So you need an extremely well-trained crew. You have to trim your boat, your submarine really well. So it has to be on the same depth constantly. Because if you, the distance between the top of the periscope and the ship is maybe 2 meters or so.
Wow.
Or sometimes it's 5, depends on the visibility of the water, but sometimes it's even 2 meters. And if that ship is only sailing for 4 knots, 5 knots. It's hard to get to keep the submarine
steady. Because you need that sort of like neutral buoyancy to stop it rising too high or even going too low so you can't see anything.
Yeah.
Wow. And were there any collisions? I mean, did they actually hit things?
Not with the Dutch submarines, no. No, there were no accidents. There was
good parachute training, obviously.
Yeah. There were some accidents, but that was only not during patrols, but it was there were fires, of course, and other problems, but no collisions with Soviet ships.
Right. And you mentioned about the operations in the Mediterranean and sort of what were the Soviets up to in the Mediterranean?
Well, the Mediterranean Sea is very important for the Soviets. They have no port there, but they want to have some influence there. So, and. Well, this started long time ago, I think in the 19th century, when the Russians wanted to go there, and they had a lot of wars and difficulties with Turkey about a passage from the Black Sea to the Mediterranean. But in the end, they want some influence, they want a lot of influence in the Mediterranean Sea. So. They did a lot of things. For example, delivering weaponry to
yeah. So they were supporting a number of states in that area.
And one of the other things is they wanted ports. And for sometimes they had some access to it, or they had their own port, but then they had to leave. They also did try to have one in Albania, and then they had to leave after a couple of years. But in the 70s, in the 80s, they were allowed to stay and to have an anchorage near Sulum, and that's on the border of Egypt and Libya, and the Gulf of Hammamet. Mm-hmm. That's another different anchorage. And there they had their floating base actually, so you had in the north part of the Mediterranean the NATO ports with the NATO Sixth Fleet or the US Sixth Fleet and all the NATO squadrons, and they had their own squadron in the Mediterranean and with floating bases. So submarine tenders and repair ships.
So these were like large supply ships that would just moor in this bay and then supply the submarines and warships that were in the area.
Yeah, and submarine could was tied next to it was to that submarine tender. The crew could get on board the submarine tender, take some rest, and. So that was the main reason why they had their anchorage,
right?
And that is an important thing because in the 60s and the 70s, the first part of the 70s, the main focus of the Dutch submarines was in the North Atlantic. But when you have a diesel electric submarine, and you have to wait for Soviet ship to pass by, and if you see that on your horizon, you can only sail for let's say 10 knots or so, or if you want to stay really quiet, you have to sail for 5 or 6 knots. Then you're never going to get close to that ship. So actually, there were mobile mines. And you had to wait for days and weeks to get lucky, and then one of the ships to get close. Mm-hmm. It's easier for these electric submarines to to go hunt for their opponents instead wait for them. And when the Soviets had their anchorage, it's easier for the diesel electric submarines to get to go there and actually visit the anchorage.
Right.
And that is what happened. To take pictures and to gather all this information, sometimes they had to go through the anchorage and had to look out that they didn't got hit by the cables that were running down to the sea bottom.
So they were right in the middle of the anchorage going through, periscope up, presumably, or no. Not taking photos?
Well, one of the stories is... it was in 83 with the Dutch submarine that the commanding officer had to take pictures of a Juliet class submarine, and that was on the other side of the anchorage. So you had to go through the whole anchorage, but the visibility is very good in the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. So if you're on periscope depth, that's 17 meters for that submarine, you can easily be seen. Even your periscope is down. If it's up, it's much easier. There are a lot of guys, Soviets, are smoking a cigarette or just smoking outside to do some maintenance. So that was really dangerous. He stayed on 50 meters.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Because he did some reconnaissance on the days before, so he knew exactly where all the ships were positioned, where the cables were running down, the anchor cables. Mm. And he listened, because all those cables were making some noise. And he listened on the sonar, and you're plotting that really well. You know where the cable is. So if there is a cable staying in the same direction, staying there when you're moving, then you know it's on collision course. So if all the cables are moving on your plot, then there is nothing going on. Then that's safe. So that's what he did. And then at the right time, he went up to periscope depth, raised his periscope, took some pictures of the Juliet, and went away.
Wow. And is there any evidence the Soviets knew that this was going on or not?
No, there is no evidence, because there were some... every time there was a submarine there in that area, of course, it was... The whole area was monitored, and there were some incidents known that if there was an MP, an airplane flying close to the anchorage or a ship, the Soviets radioed that to their headquarters, and they changed sometimes their frequency of the radar, so turned off some systems, and that didn't happen during that submarine operations. So of course, that does not mean that it was completely unknown, but it also means that that was the conclusion, that they were not detected at that moment.
Okay. Now, it sounds like there's possibly loads of other stories out there that you don't necessarily know about. Do you think those are likely to get released at some point? And is there going to be an In Deepest Secrecy 2?
I think there will be an In Deepest Secrecy too, yeah. But I think I have the most important stories of Dutch Cold War submarine operations in this book. I've interviewed 30 former submariners, that did a lot of many missions, because I had the crew list. I knew exactly who did most of the missions, so I picked out the right submariners. And I don't think there are still great stories to tell about that that time frame that I don't know.
Yeah.
But after that time, there was Dutch submarines were involved in the during Operation Sharp Guard, NATO Sharp Guard in the after the Kosovo War and the Yugoslavia crisis. That time frame, they were also involved in that in the Mediterranean.
Right. So there are further stories to tell there.
A lot of stories, yeah.
Great. Be looking forward to that. Now, what surprised me was these missions were not technically part of NATO operations.
No.
Can you tell me why that would be? Because you'd imagine that these should have been part of NATO operations.
Well, What the submarines wanted to, what why they were sent there to the Soviets was to gather information and to store all this information in a database. But the user of the database is, of course, the intelligence services. And, because it was a Dutch submarine, it was not, They didn't want to share it immediately with all NATO members. The intelligence services work like they used to trade their information and not share that immediately, especially in that time. So that's why it were not NATO operations. And there is also one thing I heard about that what the experiences about NATO was that it was not really that sometimes there was some information that leaked out.
Yeah, it wasn't secure.
No.
The information. That's what I'd imagined, is that obviously the wider you share information, the more chance that your adversaries are going to find out about that.
Yeah, there was some example, like when a submarine is sent to a sailing, then they use a sub note, and they have to sail in a virtual box, so everyone knows that in that area you're not allowed with your submarine, otherwise you have a collision, and that sub note is transmitted through all NATO, some part of NATO. One of the commanding officers commanding officer of a submarine in the 70s told me that when they got a subnote that they were leaving Den Helder and going to the south, then there was always a trawler, an AGI, on the south. And so what they did after that happened quite a few times. When they went to the south, and then they had to sub note that they were going to the Atlantic, to Madeira, but then they secretly went to the Strait of Gibraltar. So, and then they never saw an AGI. So that means that somehow the Soviets were reading those sub notes,
right?
And that was So when you share it in a large community, then there are more risks that leaks out, and you don't have something to trade.
Yeah, yeah. And so the Dutch were then trading this information for, I don't know, to get stuff from NATO?
No, not from NATO, but presumably with other NATO members. But this is the intelligence part of this story.
Yeah, this is the stuff that, you can't really cover.
No.
Okay, we better leave it there then. We mentioned right at the start that you've written a fictional book based on these submarine operations. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I did some 30 interviews or more with former submariners, and some interviews took 2.5 hours. So there was a lot of information and a lot of stories, really interesting stories. And after I heard some of the stories, I thought, well, it would be great to use for a book, a new fiction book. And that book is so it's based on a few of those stories, but I changed that, of course, a different time and a different submarines. And this book is about a commanding officer who is a bit in a problem because he had an incident in the year before. But he is on the only submarine which is operational at that time, with the trained crew, and the submarine is okay. So he's sent out to go for a patrol in the north. But it's a bit, the patrol is boring because it's just a vast area and there is nothing to hear. And the crew has to do some things for recreation. And one of the things is the ship's newspaper. And one of the guys who's writing the ship's newspaper, he wants to make it a great newspaper and to get some credits and to be successful and to be seen, because he's new on that submarine. And when he gets some news about Dutch frigates that are in Mediterranean and they're heading back to Den Helder, he changes that news and writes down a story about that they're not going to Den Helder but to the Black Sea for a freedom of navigation operation. And while he's covering that fake news story, obviously, and that things getting out of hand during that operation, and
don't give it all away.
No. It's getting really interesting. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll be providing links to both the non-fiction book, In Deepest Secrecy, and also the fiction book, which I think is called Orca.
Yeah.
Well, Jamie, thank you for all of that. That's a great amount of information and will have certainly have whetted people's appetites to read the book further, because I can assure readers there is a load more interesting operational detail in the book. Now, normally with my author guests, we do have what I call a quick fire round, which is a few fun questions. Well, I hope you'll find these fun anyway, Jamie. What is your favorite Cold War themed or Cold War era film?
That is A Hunt for Red October.
A man after my own heart. Okay, tell me why.
Because of the music, the whole story, the characters, and also after I saw the making of and how the crew prepared themselves to do that role, and after that I was really even more a fan of that.
But you being a submarine expert must look at that film and say, no, they didn't do it like that, or that's not possible, or things like that, surely.
Yeah, that's true, of course, but it's fiction, and that's what you get when you have to tell that complete story in, let's say, 2 hours or so.
Yeah.
And reach a big audience. Of course you have It won't be that realistic. It is not a documentary.
No, it is good entertainment.
Yeah.
If you can excuse Sean Connery's attempt at Russian. If you were making a film about the Cold War, what piece of music would be the soundtrack?
Well, the soundtrack of The Hunt for October is great.
Yeah.
And the soundtrack of Crimson Tide is great as
another
well.
Another great submarine movie. Yeah. Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. And the soundtrack by Hans Zimmer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really terrific.
Yeah. I haven't watched that in a while, actually. I'll have to dig that one out. That is a good film. Have you ever seen the film The Bedford Incident with Richard Widmark? Black and white Cold War movie with a frigate chasing a Russian submarine.
No.
I recommend that. Okay. It's good. It's good. It's set early Cold War. It's sort of like 50s, early 60s. But it pops up on the TV every once in a while. Bedford Incident. And I recommend that to listeners as well. So my next question would be, if you could invite three personalities from the Cold War, living or dead, to have a few drinks with, who would they be and what questions would you ask? It doesn't have to be three. It could be two. It could be one.
Well, when I did the research for my book, I really happy and really lucky that a lot of important former submariners were still alive and I could interview them. And so I had really great interviews, but there's only one who passed away a few years before I started with research. And he was commanding officer of the submarine service when they started with the first patrol. And it's really too bad that because those were so secret, there are no documents still. And so he was the one in the end who knew what was arranged, what the details were the commanding officers get. And so that guy I would have asked a lot of questions.
So there are stories from the early Cold War that are just completely unknown and undocumented then. Is that the period you're talking about there?
Yeah. Well, they're not completely unknown because there's still some submariners who were in that, who were on, for example, on that submarine in that in the first mission. But there were, most of them were junior submariners, junior officers at the time, or even the commanding officer of that submarine doesn't know exactly what happened before that, before he got that order to go to sail there and to do that operation.
Right. So this guy that you were talking about would have known the whole picture.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, there might be an archive somewhere that you've not necessarily laid your hands on.
Hopefully, yeah.
Now, I think I probably know the answer to this one, but are there books or a book or websites that you would particularly recommend for anyone interested in Cold War submarine operations? Now, obviously, there's your own esteemed publications, but what else is there out there?
Well, the first book I read about this topic was Blind Man's Bluff, and really great classic book on this topic.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Another book was published, I think, 2015, The Silent Deep by Peter Hennessy and James Jinks. Really great, great book. A lot of stories, and I used it quite a few times for my research.
Right, and that's Royal Navy focused, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the whole the history of the Royal Navy submarine service from 1945 until.
It's quite a hefty tone. Jamie's got it here on his kitchen table. That looks a good one. I'll have to add that to my birthday list.
Yeah, well, it's really, and the letters are also, the letter font is quite small.
Ooh, looks like about 800 pages, that, yeah. when I leafed to the back. Wait. There, but it looks all good stuff.
Yeah, it's really intriguing. It's really interesting, and it's not. That is a great book. Yeah. Easy read as well.
Okay. And any other books you'd recommend?
Yeah. Another one is Hunter Killers by Ian Ballantyne. And that's a bit about the same stories, the same idea that I had with my book. These are a lot of this is also, of course, about the Royal Navy submarine service, but also with a lot of new stories and new adventures that I didn't know about. So I really recommend those books.
Yeah, that one looks good. It's subtitled "The Dramatic Untold Story of the Royal Navy's Most Secret Service." So I will be adding links to all of those books in the show notes. Are there any websites that you can recommend? There's obviously yours, which I can't remember the link for.
Well, the name is marineschepen.nl.
I'm so glad you said that, not me. I'll add links to that in the show notes.
Yeah, but I started also with my English language website. It's still a bit hard, but it's naviesworldwide.com. And that's mostly about the current topics about submarines and the Dutch submarine replacement and the new mine countermeasure vessels. So.
Right. So it keeps going. The story keeps going.
The story keeps going. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Jamie, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you on Cold War Conversations. I hope you've enjoyed the ride. It hasn't been too bad.
Yeah, I enjoyed it very much.
Well, that's it for this episode. However, there's photos of my visit to the Royal Netherlands Navy Museum at Den Helder and links to Jamie's book in the show notes, which are at coldwarconversations.com/episode and the number 70. Don't forget, you can support us and get a Cold War Conversations coaster at patreon.com. That's patreon.com/coldwarpod. If you like what you're hearing in the podcast, you can really help us by leaving reviews on iTunes, Stitcher, our Facebook page, or with your favorite podcast provider. This really helps raise our profile and get new guests on the show. If you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group where our guests and listeners, just like you, continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations on Facebook. We're also on Twitter at Cold War Pod and Instagram at Cold War Conversations. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.